Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. It's me, Simon Cardy, with Matthew Purslow.
Hello.
Joe Screbbles.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Gosh, busy today suddenly. Little peek behind the curtain, we're recording this about 20 minutes after the Uncharted trailer dropped.
28 minutes. Thank you.
A real peek behind the curtain. Not even a peek, we're pulling it right off the rails.
Don't mind.
Some reattaching. Sorry, what was that?
I was just gonna be grim.
Vulgar. You're gonna be vulgar.
Vulgar. That's the term.
It's a lot to talk about today. Not only we've had to add Uncharted to the mix, because we can't not talk about that, can we? Because there's things to say. There was DC fandom over the weekend. We'll catch up on a few things from that. A couple of games you might not have heard of that you might be interested, because we enjoy them quite a bit. And if we enjoy them, there's always the chance you might enjoy them. And then we've got some film, TV, and I've also, for the first time it feels like in years, got an actual proper podcast drop. I got to speak to Denis Villeneuve, director of Dune. So we've got a nice little 15-minute chat with him. We'll probably do that before The Endless Search, I reckon. So no spoilers in it either. So if you're looking forward to the film, it won't spoil it at all.
What we're saying, lovely. It's going to be a really fucking long one.
Settle in.
Strap in, boys. We're going to be here
for ages.
I hope
you're stuck in traffic, because, you know, we had a 100-minute one the other day. Will this approach it? Who knows? I'm going to... A tantalising yes from me. Why don't we just get on with it? The Uncharted trailer dropped. What do we think? Because I think we're all on the same page of this. I don't think it looks terrible. I don't think it looks by any means good. But it's just... I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on the casting. But from that trailer...
I just can't do it. It's
they're
not
far
them.
Too young.
It's no, not them, is
that
it?
That is not... Mark Wahlberg and Tom Holland are not Sully and Drake, are they? They're just not.
It's weird when you think, like, we're in the world of the MCU, and, you know, DC have done this pretty well, where they've got comic book characters that have only ever lived as images on a page, and they found perfect people for those roles. And yet, they've got more to work with this time, because they've got actual kind of, like, you know, for lack of a better term, living, breathing CGI characters that they can use as kind of reference. They've just found people that don't embody those personalities at all. At least, you know, I haven't seen, obviously, any more than, what is it, a 2-minute trailer, but there's just doesn't evoke the right feeling for me.
It's just, and the problem, like...
If Mark Wahlberg...
I like Tom Holland.
If Mark Wahlberg can't be asked to grow a moustache to play Sully, then... You know, I think that says all we need to know.
Exactly. Just put the moustache. He's got one iconic feature, is a cigar and a moustache. Unless the end of this film is him lighting a cigar and putting on a fake moustache, I'm not interested.
I truly think by the end of the film he will have a moustache, to be fair. I'm being a little facetious. But it is one of those things where you're like, they must know that, like, fans are going to be... Because I'm not attached to the Uncharted mythos at all. Like, I like a couple of those games quite a lot. They're fun games, but I'm not a follower. But even I am a bit like, I mean, fucking, like, does it have to be? Does it need to be this different? Like, what is the point of these situations if this is what we're doing with it?
It just feels off, because I don't really know how much this film is covering as well, because there seems to be things from pretty much all four games that I spotted from that trailer, and like you point out just before we recorded, Matt, like. And we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt, because when they cast Tom Holland, they kind of postured that this was a prequel of sorts to the games, not really connected. It's the complete opposite of that. They've bunged as much as they can from the games.
It's like the abridged version of the entire series, from the look of it.
Well, here's my guess is We've heard previously that Mark Wahlberg is only signed on to do one Uncharted movie. So I wonder if they're just going, we pretty much know that we're only going to do this once. So we might as well put in all the stuff that we can put in trailers now and not save it up. And so it feels to me like it's not even like abridged. It's just going, here is an origin story that happens to have every major set piece you care about, maybe minus Nepal. Although I guarantee the second trailer will start with him hanging off a cliff in Nepal. But yeah, we'll see. I just find myself quite lukewarm on the entire affair.
And the CG does look quite ropey. No pun intended, like he's hanging off ropes and stuff. But it doesn't look great. I mean, it's the complete opposite of what I'm getting from the last of us HBO show. Whenever I see a set photo of that or hear someone talking about that, it looks like they're doing a proper, like, prestige HBO drama job on that. Mm-hmm. Whereas I watch this trailer, I'm like, this looks naff, frankly.
It is. I know this is not a wildly original thing to say at this point, but we are at the point where big prestige TV series are where you get, like, the legit versions of these adaptations or these tales. And when you do a movie of it, unless you're Marvel, it does feel a little bit like, oh, this is the cash grab that we're used to from licensed things. I wouldn't be surprised to feel very similar about Borderlands down the line. Whereas it does feel like The Last of Us holds up to the scrutiny of a series and the weight of a series. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to fuck about with that.
The reason they've gone with this more younger direction is because, obviously, Uncharted owes a lot to Indiana Jones. And they're going, well, if we just cast someone like Indiana Jones, we're basically making Indiana Jones. Do you think they've tried to get away from that? I don't know.
That's what Uncharted is, right? It just feels to me, it's like, pick what flavour of the month is. And it's like, everybody loves Tom Holland, right? So just use Tom Holland as your vehicle. It's just, I don't know, it feels very cynical to me.
We'll see. Well, it's out in February. It's not far away, so not long till we actually see it. I don't know. I'm intrigued. Trailer's not hopeful, but I want to enjoy it. Because unlike Joe, I am a huge Uncharted fan. One of my favourite series of games. And yeah, I want this to be good. But sadly, we may not get that. Who knows? Some more promising things, though, from DC fandom. I think we can all agree. I haven't actually spoken about you. I'm just assuming that we all agree that the Batman looks fantastic.
Yup.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
I wasn't even, before this trailer, I wasn't totally, like, I liked the seveniness of it, but I wasn't totally sold on big goth Batman. But something about this one just really worked for me. Like, it feels way more angry than sulky, I think, at this point. And that's where I want my Batman. I want him
furious. He's vengeance. He's pure vengeance. Yeah, I want to see more of it. And I know why they're not showing more of him, because it's going to be a big part of the film, but Paul Dano as the Riddler is just dream casting.
Oh, come on. Dano in anything is dream casting.
I know. That shot, I assume about 99% sure that's him at the diner right at the start.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you never know with these things. But he looks exactly like the character he plays in Prisoners, if anyone's seen Prisoners. And I just kind of wish it was the same universe and he's kind of grown up and just... this tormented child has become the Riddler.
My best mate sent me a message straight afterwards just saying, is Paul Dano the Riddler? And I said, he is. He said, I saw lank hair and Deirdre glasses and put two and two together.
Sorry, your best mate? Like, why does that leave us?
Let's not get into it. It's a very complicated algorithm I have to run.
It's like a big, it's a big system, point system each month, monthly leaderboard.
Seeds, a lot of seeding going on.
What do we? I'm into Colin Farrell's mad laughing penguin.
It's great. It's so. The thing I really like about this is it's got that kind of grit that the Nolan stuff had, but it's like real super stylized grit that goes into like the comic book mythos, and so you get like a proper comic book penguin, and like he is bananas. But that's what you want now. Like all of Batman's villains are in the insane asylum, like inmates, aren't they? Like go absolutely fully balls to the wall with it. I love it.
It does feel like, you know, we've had, and maybe this is doing down Matt Reeves' vision because I haven't seen it yet, but to me, you have, like, these such distinct versions of on-screen Batman, like TV series, Burton, Schumacher, Nolan, and then this. And before this, all of them feel like they sit in their own pockets of how you tell that story. This one, to me, feels like it's taking quite a midpoint between Nolan's grit and Burton's like over-the-top gothic sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And like something about that's really working for me now. Like I'm really into it. As soon as I watched this, I went and bought and read for the first time Batman Year One, because I know that it's somewhat going in that direction. And yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing, like, Frank Miller's, you know, questionable attitudes towards women notwithstanding, I wouldn't mind seeing some of the some of that, like, replicated on screen, like this feeling of him just being so alone, and so without tools. It just feels like that feels really cool to me.
And Zoe Kravitz seems like a perfect Catwoman as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like we don't see see a bit of her in the trade fair. We haven't really seen, like, a full scene or anything yet, obviously, but she definitely has the look of Catwoman, and Andy Serkis as Alfred works perfectly for me, because to me he's just doing the London version of his prestige role.
And I have to say, that's the one bit I'm not yet convinced on, but I've only seen him in, like, literally a glimpse and a couple of lines, so I'm not entirely sure.
I can't wait. And the rumours are that it's basically almost a 3-hour psychological thriller, basically. 100% is what I want.
This does feel like it's going to be the Batman detective story that we never get on screen. You know, if this is a serial killer mystery that happens to have a man with electric hands running around, I'm super into it. Give me more.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm ready.
I kind of hope it's a one-off as well. Like, they haven't really said it, but like, it'd just be cool to get these one-off stories. Like, they do keep talking about a Joker sequel. I don't know if anyone needs that. Like, just do these one-off stories, just like these one-off graphic novels that sit by themselves.
Imagine if Batman fucking died at the end. It would be great. Like, it would be really amazingly good way to just be like Pattinson just going, fuck off, I'm doing it once. This is it.
Yeah.
I'd
take it.
It's one of those, though, like, I know I haven't seen the film yet, but everything about that trailer is what I want from a Batman film. And I sort of don't like the idea that we might have to let that go immediately.
Yeah.
Even if it's like, I would really like them to perhaps, like, have an element that brings, like, Nightwing into it, and you can have a Nightwing, like, that stays within that Gotham and has that tone.
Or if Zoe Kravitz's Catwoman is a breakout. You could see that. Like,
there is that Nightwing film that's been in gestation for, like, 5 years at this point.
Yeah.
And they've said this isn't our priority. Like, you could totally, if Batman did really well, you could totally see them being like, okay, here's fucking dark Dick Grayson. Like, I'd be well into that.
Amazing. Yeah, can't wait for that. That's April. It's not far away either. So, it's all coming. Everything's coming. Gotham Knights, more Batman. We don't actually know when that's coming yet, do we? Is it still just next year?
It's just next year. I would guess if they do stick to the 2022 for that and Suicide Squad, then you're getting first half Gotham Knights, second half Suicide Squad.
I could see it late spring, summer. Gotham Knights, we didn't, like, we got the Court of Owls trailer, which everyone wanted to see the Court of Owls in this game. I was surprised we didn't see any actual, because last year we saw a good, like, 10-15 minute chunk of gameplay. I'm surprised we didn't see any more actual gameplay.
I think they thought they were making DC fandom really lean and mean this year, but it was actually just a 4-hour show with about 6 bits that anyone gave a shit about. I was surprised by that. I do wonder if there have been changes since last year, even though I didn't come away thinking it was going to be, it looked very bad, but I think there was a lot of worry about things like the combat system and stuff like that. And not seeing it now and hearing them sort of talk around combat in the little behind the scenes thing they put up, like, does make me feel like there's something maybe different. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm overthinking it.
Just make it 4-player, because that's what everyone wanted. Everyone's like, why is this game that has 4 stars 2-player only? Like, add 4. I want to play. I have lots of friends, Joe, that I like playing games with.
I've only got one best friend, so that's
exactly. So yeah, problem solved for you. You'd like all games to be 2-player and 2-player only.
Yeah, absolutely. if possible, please.
If you are looking for 4-player, though, you've got Suicide Squad.
Yeah,
which we did get a proper look at. Not again, not gameplay, but we did get a look at pretty much all of the Justice League that you will be supposedly killing in this game. It's just weird to see. It's been, like, so long that, like, we've never really seen the Flash or Green Lantern. Like, I'm just, how are you going to fight them in this? I'm sure they'll be like boss fights where you have to slow the Flash down with electrical grenades or something. Just that'll be what the game is.
Big spears of kryptonite that you can lob into him.
But how does, you know, Harley Quinn, who basically just has a baseball bat and a grenade, take down Green Lantern?
It does feel like that's going to be the joke, though, right? Like, is that not going to be the deal? Is that's the humour of the game, is them kind of fucking around and just trying to make it work and Wonder Woman ending up saving their asses?
This is going to be the actual plot of the game, is you do go through all of them and kill them, or do you think that's going to be within the first half of the game, the course is just going to change and it's going to be...
I absolutely think that. Yeah, I think it's... Because it's Brainiac, right, is the baddie. So it feels like you then... The Suicide Squad have their moral turn and go, okay, we're going to kill the big bad guy that's controlling them instead of killing the Justice League or something like that. Yeah, I don't know. Exactly. It doesn't... I bet you'll kill one. I reckon you will kill one of them, and that will be its big, like, Suicide Squad moment.
Which one? Which one's going down? Matt, which one of the Justice League do you want to kill?
Out of the ones that we've seen so far, like, probably Wonder Woman's the easiest to kill.
But then she doesn't look like she's corrupted. She's fighting Superman in that thing.
That is true,
so I reckon it's going to be Flash, because they show him being a little prick.
Or Batman. Yeah. They do show Lex Luthor's head just exploding as well.
That's not Lex Luthor, I don't think. He's a LexCorp scientist who looks weirdly like Justin Theroux. but apparently he's just a scientist, people were saying.
And this is the one, just to not confuse people, this is the one that takes place in the Arkham universe.
Yes.
From the Rocksteady games. Gotham Knights is actually in a separate Gotham. Mm-hmm. So consider it a multiverse. That's somewhere else.
You can tell because both things had a big focus on the Penguin. Like, of all the characters, the Penguin was in both, and the Arkham Penguin is in the Suicide Squad trailer, so you can tell. There's also a shot that looks curiously like a Batman's gauntlet pointing a gun at Harley Quinn's head. Or it could be Jason Todd. I do think we are going to see people from the Arkham games popping up in this. Also, I
can't wait for you for those.
When I first saw the trailer, I was like, oh my god, this looks absolutely incredible. Like, visuals wise, it looks amazing. And me and a few people were like chatting on WhatsApp, and all we're talking about, we're all big Arkham Knight defenders. And it's
a great game.
And it was £3 on Steam. So we're like, okay, we'll get that and boot it up and look at it now. It's still like the fucking best looking PS4 game ever released. Like, it's insane.
I had my week off last week, and it's on Game Pass, so I just downloaded it, played the first hour again. I was like, this is still brilliant. Even the tank stuff, it's not that bad.
The only bad bits of the tank stuff are the stealth tank stuff, which is stupid.
And also, it's not in it as much as you think it is. Like, when you go back to it, there's a very small percentage of that game that's made up of those stealth tanks.
But yeah, it's a joke how good that game looks. And it, like, genuinely, because I was watching that trailer, I was like, oh, Rocksteady are really good. And I was like, oh no, they made a game that looked almost this good 6 years ago. Worth pointing out, because I didn't realise, they released all three Arkham games within 6 years, and it's taken them longer to get to the release of this game after Arkham Knight, which is, the work ethic on that studio back in the day was absurd.
So good. I could go back and play this.
Work ethic, or, you know, maybe more questionable reasons.
Well, I suppose they had the bones of those games, didn't they? It's the same city, same combat system, a lot of the same characters. Like, I'm not saying it's easy. Yeah. I'm not saying you could do it in a month.
The first two were made in the same engine as well, weren't they? Yes, so I'm sure there was. But that step up to, like, because Arkham Knight is my favourite out of a lot of them. I think it's such a fucking good game. But the rain in that game on the cape and everything. Yeah.
That's the thing. Well, wasn't also just the structure of Arkham Knight makes me really excited to see Suicide Squad, because I just want another open world game that has the balls to work that way and to make every mission feel like it matters. There's nothing else like it. There's literally nothing else like it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Last year when it was revealed, didn't they say like the biggest thing they learned or biggest adjustment they had to make was that they were making a game set in daylight, which is probably what has taken a long time, because games that are darker and are rainy and have a lot of fire do look good, I think. Like, they're things that naturally look good, so they're having to adjust everything to now do a daytime city, which I'm sure will still be amazing. That is definitely one of our most anticipated games. We've got a few more things from DC fandom that, I mean, I'm not personally as excited about, but I know others may be. That we saw a look at the Flash movie, which a lot of people excited about seeing Michael Keaton's Batman potentially. Is that him? It is him, but you know, no one says it is him. They basically show his Batmobile as well. I really like Michael Keaton's Batman. I don't have that nostalgic sort of ties to him that some people have. Like, see, a lot of people really excited that he's in this film. I think he's a very good Batman, don't get me wrong, but I think it definitely is outweighed by how much I'd really just don't like Ezra Miller. Like, I'm just not excited for this film. And it has been pointed out, like, is this and the next Spider-Man film the same plot? Like, are they doing a very similar film here?
I suppose some of this is, like, inspired by Flashpoint, right? Which is, and you know, Spider-Man has its basis in its own comics, but I suppose there's a certain amount of crossover there. I don't know. I quite like Muschietti as a director. Like, I was less fond of the second part of it, but I think the first part of it is very, very good. And so, like, I hope that he does a good job. And we've got, you know, there's some nice... There'll be Supergirl in it as well. Like, I'm hoping that he does some fun stuff there. Like, yeah. I'm on board, I think. Like, I will bite on the Keaton stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've also got Black Adam with The Rock playing Black
Adam. He was
Adam.
Born to play him, apparently. That's what he said.
Was he? Literally, yeah. Like, he was, they,
apparently
were
so.
At birth, they were like, they should have called him Black Adam then. That should have been his name.
Let's think it through.
I don't... I don't know a lot about Black Adam, actually. Should I be excited about this?
It's not... I mean, like, Black Adam isn't something I'm... I'm most familiar with Black Adam through the Injustice games, I will say that. Mm-hmm. I'm generally always interested in seeing The Rock play a slightly bad guy. I think that's interesting. I'm generally more interested in just watching people go absolutely insane for The Rock, like, not least because of traffic on websites. But it's like, he's like, I have to say, like, it was fascinating to me to see how much Black Adam dominated almost every other story from fandom for us. Like, it really is a marker of how much Big Dwayne means to people.
Yeah.
Also,
I will say,
imagine being called Dwayne and having that effect on people. Incredible. he's single-handedly rehabilitated the name Dwayne.
What, after Dwayne Dibley from Red Dwarf?
Yeah, Dwayne Dibley.
What brought it down?
Yeah. I mean, there was Dwayne Wade, who played basketball very well, but he was Dwayne instead of Dwayne. So, you know, we took stepping stones together.
I think last week I misheard something. I was listening to a podcast or something. I can't remember what I was listening to. And I misheard as The Rock as Black Adder. And I was like, they're rebooting Black Adder with The Rock.
Yes, give it to me now. I mean, would be way more excited.
I don't know what historical
Statham
period.
Baldrick.
Yeah,
I don't know. Like, we'd have to be after World War One, wouldn't it? Because that was the last one. So I don't know. Like,
Vietnam,
60s Cold War era, Vietnam, Blackadder,
Vietnam,
with the Rock.
Blackadder, with a really sexy Baldrick. I don't know who it would be.
well, wouldn't it? Would it be Vin Diesel? I don't know.
They won't work together. Absolutely
no,
not.
But
I mean,
I'd want to bring them together.
The Rock would love Vin Diesel to play Baldrick. That would really help his side of the feud.
I think we've stumbled across an idea here that a few people would watch.
Idris Elba as Baldrick. Just someone incredibly handsome. Just prattin' about. Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. It's a shame we get Black Adam instead. But I'm sure it might be fun. I don't know a lot about Adam.
Shazam was very good. I enjoyed Shazam. So, you know, if it's like...
There
it's
was
got
a
anything
Shazam
in the vibe.
2 trailer as well, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Not into it? Okay.
Well, it was just behind the scenes. It was just stuff. Just theme stuff.
Just stuff. Things and stuff. One more thing you want to talk about, Joe, is the Caped Crusader.
Yeah. It's like... So I'm not a big Batman the Animated Series guy, but I know people are super into it. But just the pitch of this thing sounds really good. It's an animated series that's trying to be like a proper 40s set noir that does the stuff that they weren't allowed to do on Batman the Animated Series. So like adult themes and actual, you know, very dark Batman stuff. But I just love the idea of seeing a proper 40s Batman detective doing stuff and not having many gadgets and, you know, and them kind of rewriting who's who. They've hinted that him and Jim Gordon will be rivals instead of friends, and at least for the first series, and said, like, all these characters, you know, the Joker and the big characters that you know from the animated series aren't going to be the same, and we're going to do different stuff with them. And I'm just like, also, and like J.J. Abrams and Matt Reeves are involved, and like, there's a lot to be excited about with that one. I think it's like quietly one of the more exciting things they've got on the burner.
You've sold me, because before this podcast, this one totally passed me by.
Yeah.
And you have sold me. It may be even more than Blackadder goes to Narm.
Blackadder gets in the shit.
Yeah. I'm just a lot of ideas swirling in my head about what this series could be.
I mean, the thumbnail for this podcast is sorted.
It's basically MASH.
Yeah.
But yeah, there we go. That's all the DC stuff. If there's something from DC fandom you liked that we just completely missed out, why not write in at IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com. Mm. Let us know what you think of all the Batman stuff and what you think of Uncharted as well. Why not? We're now going to talk about some games and films that you may not have watched or played that you think you might like. Mm. We're going to start off with Inscription, which
yes.
I've played 2 hours of and I'm hooked. Joe, I believe you finished already.
Yeah, I finished it in 2 prolonged stints. I just couldn't stop playing it. I was obsessed. I stayed up till 3 a.m. the first night I had it.
You're a madman. Why do you love it so?
'Cause it's just the best. Like, to explain, it starts, let's go way back. Daniel Mullins is a guy that has made 2 previous games, one called Pony Island that a lot of people played, and one called The Hex that lots of people didn't, including me. I have not played The Hex, but both of them do very interesting metatextual games stuff. They are games about games that are lots of different game genres, and they hide dark storylines behind the game you initially start playing. And they're very clever and sort of self-referential. But I thought Pony Island in particular, I didn't actually like the game. Like, the game element I hated compared to the story it was telling, which was very smart. Inscription is a game where I absolutely love the core game, and it's doing all that clever shit on top of it. So the first thing that happens is you turn on the game and you get this hint that what you are watching might be found footage. Like, there's this kind of VHS effect, and you get this sense of like, okay, so am I watching someone playing a game, but I'm the player? And then the next thing is you can't press new game. You can only press continue. And when you press continue, you start at a table in the dark and this pair of disembodied eyes literally creak open and start teaching how to play a card game. And the card game itself is super interesting. And this is what I love about Inscription, is as someone who has liked a lot of card games and played a lot of card games, the one he's invented is genuinely intriguing. Like, it has this weird set, like it's all built around death. So it plays like Magic the Gathering. You cast creatures and then try and deal damage to the person on the other side of the table until they run out of life. Life, incidentally, is done on scales. So if you do 3 damage and they do 2 damage, they tip the scales back towards you instead of having 2 separate life tokens, which is super interesting in and of itself, but let's not get into it. But you essentially play creatures that cost blood, and to get blood, you have to kill your existing creatures to get them. So it's this constant like feedback loop of like, how am I having the most effective set of creatures on here to defend myself and kill the other person? And that's just the base level game.
Mm-hmm.
As you start playing, more and more mechanics get thrown in, and then weird shit starts happening, like certain cards will draw and then start talking to you. And it turns out some of those cards are alive, and it's not clear why. Then it's revealed you can just get up from the table and walk around the room you're in, and you realize that surrounding the card game is an escape room game where you're trying to figure out how to get out of playing the card game in the first place. And this is Act 1. Like, there is so much more. Like, so much more.
Yeah, I'm like, for all the reasons you just said there, I'm hooked already. Like, it sounds like a potentially complicated game. It's really not.
It's
called very simple, and it teaches you everything step by step. Like you said, the card game is cool. Core is just fun to play. Then all the stuff around it is where I got hooked, because it has that sort of puzzle game, sort of The Room-esque sort of stuff to be doing. And Like, I'm only, like I said, I'm only 2 hours in. I got up to the second boss in the card game so far. Yeah. So I'm learning bits. I've unlocked certain bits of this room and found things that I can use. There's like weird things happening, and like you said, like dark things happening as well.
It's
like,
gross.
I don't think on the scales it's measured in teeth.
Yes,
which like for like one item you can get during this card game is just a pair of pliers, which it doesn't tell you what it does. It just says, "Oh, tip the scales in your favor," basically. And what you do with those pair of pliers is pull out one of your own teeth and put it onto the scales.
It's fucking grim.
Yeah, and there's like things like that, which I won't spoil, happening like quite often.
Yeah,
odd characters. The sound design is just, it's not a scary game, but at times it is,
in a literal sense, it is a dreadful game. Like, you feel dread constantly. I was just playing it. Mm-hmm. There were bits where, and I genuinely think this is useful to know for certain people, and I don't consider it a spoiler, there are no jump scares in this game. It's a game that feels like it might be about to jump at you the whole time. And what I actually think it does really well is, even when you start to realize it never is, you still feel like you're right on the edge of something fucking horrible happening the whole time. And it just, it has this really smart approach, and you'll get further with it, Cardi, but it has this really smart approach to, like, what is the story of the room you're in? What's the story of the card game? What's the story of maybe watching? And, like, starts to interleave how all these things work and which ones affect the others. And it's just fucking fascinating. And, like, I can't go any further towards explaining anything else because it is the meaning of the game. But fuck me. It's like, I'm still in the afterglow of it, but it feels very much like Game of the Year for me at the moment. Like, I just love it.
Absolutely, it is quite absorbing. And, like, I'm at the point now where I think, anyway, that I know what I've got to do. Basically, I'm at a point where I've got everything I need. I just need to defeat the card game part of it, or the part of the card game I'm at the point.
Yeah.
So I've got things I need, and basically they're just telling me now, you've got to defeat him. Mm. So, like, I've got to do that, and I just, I can't wait to see what happens next. There's also the thing of, so, like a card game or a rogue, it's got kind of rogue-like elements. So it's like a deck building. As you go, each time you die, you start again.
Yeah, if you've played Slay the Spire, it's the same principle of you build a deck, you evolve your deck as you play the game through a series of like choices of where to go on a map.
It's got a really cool thing of when you die, you create a card that is basically your card, and you do that from combining. So you choose like parts of three other cards that were in your deck from the run before, and that becomes your card, which you can draw and put yourself on the. It's just, there's a lot going on.
If you're super into card games, this is like in itself a meditation on how card games are designed and how a lot of the fun for people who are super into them is working out how to break the rules of a card game, like how to cheese it. And I think the super interesting thing is, the further you go on, the further you realize that he's made a card game that has specific loopholes that you can find and work out ways to completely destroy the balance of the game to help you get through it. To the point where, like, you can be beating those boss characters in like two turns if you've created a deck that works that way.
I got lucky on one. Yeah, I basically had an item that won it for me.
Yeah,
like, essentially,
it's bonkers. Like, it's just such a great bit of game design at the same time as story design. It also looks beautiful. Like, it's a bizarre looking game, but it's got the core sort of walking around has got this like grainy texture to everything that looks some like VHS 90s like PS1 fucked up style, but quite cleanly done. Like, it's really good.
Yeah, it's published by Devolver. It's on Steam on PC only at the moment. I don't know if there are plans for it to come to anything else at any point, but
haven't heard
at the moment it's on Steam on PC. Matt, you would definitely like this game.
Yeah, it sounds wicked. Like, I had no idea. Like, Joe has said to me now several times about how much he's enjoying it, but has not mentioned anything about what it is, and I've seen some screenshots, and even from screenshots, that can't possibly prepare you for what that description of the game is. I obviously like anything that has kind of like those levels within levels within levels. Like that sounds like, I like the, I'm almost seeing like the Venn diagrams of how one element affects the next one. Like, that's definitely going on the list.
It's one of those things I think you could like quite easily assume he's made as like three separate things. and put them together, but then you realise the elegance with which they're put together means he must have had this as a complete vision from the start.
Part of that kind of reminds me of like how House Abandon is built within in Stories Untold, how that's kind of a game mm-hmm. within this kind of environment, and the environment yeah. outside the game is affecting how you feel about the internal game. And I like that kind of, that sounds like a good sort of jam.
That's a really good comparison. Like it has mm-hmm. it has a lot of that to it.
I was feeling that as well. Even like some of the grain, the art style we were talking about, I was thinking, and it's Devolver as well, like yeah, it's got a bit of that Stories Untold to it as well. Like mm-hmm. yeah, it's just very good. Yeah, I'd recommend to anyone who has a PC, give it a go. Prop Night is another game that kind of came out of nowhere. Matt, you previewed this game.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a mishmash of two kind of genres and game modes that no one's really put together before and should work, and they do work.
Yeah, I genuinely was very pleasantly surprised by this because it came into us with us having no idea what it was. We were literally just told, it's called Prop Night, here's a code for it. So you're like installing it, wondering, what the hell is this? And yeah, it turns out to be, it is essentially a Dead by Daylight clone, but you can turn into like inanimate objects in it. So like you can turn into a cabbage and roll around, which like initially sounds very, very weird and very dumb, but it's surprising how well it works. And like it's one that we've been able to all play as a big IGN mm-hmm. group.
Mm.
But yeah, the fundamentals are, is if you don't know what Dead by Daylight is, you essentially, it's an asynchronous horror multiplayer game in which you have four kind of teenage survivors that must escape from one other player-controlled monster, very much kind of plucked from that kind of like the horror archetype book. So there's kind of like a banshee-like nun, there's a freaky old woman with a big old butcher's knife, there's the doppelganger that can turn into like the characters that it stalks and trick them that way, and then there's kind of the keymaster who's almost like a hunchback with a giant sort of like big mallet and the ability to summon spectral eyes. They're all kind of very creepy.
As you do.
Yes, yeah. As you do. You know, everybody wants to summon a spectral eye once in a while, don't they? But the whole point is that those four like survivors need to escape from the map, and the way they do that is by going around and finding these machines, and you have to fix the machine. It takes a very, very long time, so it's a very tense kind of moment because you're very vulnerable while you're doing it. And once you've fixed, I think it's five of them, it will open the door to the map and you can escape out the map. And mm-hmm. so the killer is trying to prevent you from doing that. If you've played Dead by Daylight, that probably sounds like almost an absurd amount of lifting the DNA of that game.
Oh, yeah.
But as like the teenagers in it, because I think the idea is it's like set in a nightmare, it's not an actual reality, and so the rules of reality are kind of bent a little bit, and those teenagers can transform into basically any item in the map that the like is within reach of them, and so that can be like if you're in the cornfield you can turn into like a scarecrow that you found there, you can turn into crates, you can turn into barrels,
carrots, rocks are OP.
Rocks, yeah. So this is it. There's a lot of very what initially feel quite overpowered items, because like if you turn into a Coke bottle, you just roll under like a bench and you can just hide there, and it's mm-hmm. very, very difficult for like the killer to spot you.
You turn into a massive bale of hay. That's not the smartest move.
No. But that does kind of like sometimes then like if you're trying to escape from the killer, you might turn into a cabbage, and yes, they can physically see you turning into the cabbage, but you're suddenly much harder to hit, so it sort of doesn't matter, whereas I think the bigger ones are more designed as hiding objects. It's like you keep out of sight and you turn into a big item. But there's kind of obviously this big push and pull, because you can't hide forever because the match is on a timer. You need to get rid of, you know, fix these five machines before the timer runs out. So there's kind of like all of this kind of hide and seek, push and pull play, and I think ultimately out of all of it, that kind of feels like good game design, and largely good because they've taken it from what is one of the most popular games on Twitch, basically. But also it's very, very funny because it's just like the concept is so absurd mm-hmm. and dumb that it just works for such a humor and like laugh anecdote factory.
Yeah. We just, I mean, that's cool. Exactly, that's what it's about. Like, it plays fine. It's not it by no means the best game I'll ever play, but it's kind of got that sort of Friday the 13th effect, hasn't it? That you get a bunch of friends together, play it, and you laugh at how bad some of you are at it, basically, or the situations you get yourself in. And yeah, it's not like it's a game. If we had five people, it's like, oh, do we fancy playing it for an hour? I'd play it. Like, it's not, you know, it's not something I'll go back to all the time. But is it out yet? Is it early access?
A beta, which I think is over now. They only ran it for a few days, but I know that I'm sure on their Steam page it said it added, because when we were playing it, there was only one map, which was set in the farm. But if you've seen the trailer for it, there's kind of like a very traditional old school Victorian haunted house kind of style thing, and you know, a few other things. And I think that house got added for that beta, but it's currently unplayable, but I assume it will come back reasonably soon. It is like surprisingly polished, really, for like I say, it doesn't play like a AAA game, but I think compared to Friday the 13th especially, which obviously has a similarish thing, this feels like it's had like an extra million bucks.
Isn't it from the same studio developing The Day Before?
It is
post-apocalyptic Last of Us MMO like game. Is it an MMO?
I think it's an MMO. Do we really know? Like, Christ knows what that game is.
It is meant to be an MMO, but it looks like The Last of Us, but with like social spaces and lots of people fighting each other and a bit Dark Zone-y.
But everybody liked the look of that, right? That looks like it's had money spent on it. Even though they're kind of like I assume they're a small developer, unless they're suddenly like 100 strong Russian developer that like cropped up out of nowhere. But as their kind of other game, I think like really nice art style. It's got a very kind of Buffy the Vampire Slayer-ish. It's not a grimy horror.
One of the characters is literally just Billie Eilish. So
there's a Billie Eilish.
Literally. She looks exactly like Billie Eilish.
To the point that Epic could use that character model if they really wanted to, if they were doing a concert. There's like one of the dudes is basically wearing like Marty McFly's Back to the Future 2 get up. There's someone that looks like, I saw someone in the comments on one of our articles about it saying like he vaguely looks like he could just be Soldier Boy. I find that quite appealing. Like, I really like the monster designs, and I think kind of like, I think it needs a bit of work. Like, it doesn't feel like it's fully balanced at the moment. I do think like the it's much easier as the survivors to succeed because of the way those props work. But I will say, Jesse is fucking incredibly good at playing the monster and decimated.
What's that say about him though?
Plays a lot of games, doesn't he?
I was going to say he's a monster. He's not a monster. Last question on Prop Night: would this be better if The Rock was playing Blackadder as one of the monsters?
But Blackadder is the monster.
Or Baldrick. Get Baldrick as
If you've watched Blackadder and not come out of it thinking he's the monster, then you've watched the wrong show.
Depends on which one you've watched, right? Because Blackadder 1, he was an absolute dimwit.
That's true.
Check out Prop Night again. PC, Steam only. We're sorry if you have a console. We're not really helping you out today much, but sorry. If that's a game that will kick off on Twitch, then I'm sure that'll be coming to consoles at some point. Couple more things. God, we've got a lot, haven't we? Let's be brief with these. Matt, you saw Halloween Kills. I haven't seen it yet. The sequel to
you.
This will be briefer. The sequel to the 2018 sequel/reboot of Halloween. Which I think we both agreed is a very good film.
I really like Halloween 2018. Yeah. I think it's like an excellent movie.
It's not. So I've heard it described as a mess. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. Very messy. I've been thinking on this film now for kind of like a week and a half, and I still don't understand what the fuck they did with it. It is, for lack of a better term, like, Halloween 2018 is a very, very distinct sequel to John Carpenter's Halloween, right? Like, it's 40 years later, it very much continues the story of Laurie Strode, and has a real, real strong kind of like idea that it chases about the idea of trauma being passed down generations of women. So by this point, Laurie is a grandmother, but it's like the trauma that she had at the hands of Michael Myers in the original film has kind of affected her relationship with her daughter, and in turn, the relationship with her granddaughter. Like, they are all like haunted by this man who hasn't been around for 40 years. Then he turns up and, you know, I'm not going to exactly say what happened in...
He's pure evil, mate. What's going to happen? Like, it's not going to be a party, is it?
No. Evil. They have a very nasty time. But luckily, you know, kind of like, they sorted at the end of Halloween 2018. Wonderful finish. Leave it there. But then this is less a sequel to that film and more like, if we're going to use video game terms, imagine if they just made like a DLC pack for it. And what they don't want to do is they don't want to put anything in that DLC that would be too game-changing, so that when people eventually pick up the actual sequel that comes out later, that they'll have missed anything.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Kind of the problem is that it's caught between being a sequel and a prequel. Because if you don't know, this is part of a trilogy. I think even, is it next year the final part is scheduled to come out, maybe?
I spoke to David Gordon Green, the director, and he said they were starting to do the filming in January on the next one.
Okay. Maybe it's not. Maybe it is next year. I don't know. But that's what I've heard the problem is. It's kind of caught between teeing up a third part and kind of dealing with what happened in the first. Are you still excited for the third part, do you think? Does it leave it on a point where the third part could still be very good?
Well, it's so completely throwaway that it wouldn't matter if this film existed or not, because basically Laurie is in it for about 15 minutes. Admittedly, this is a film that is barely touching 100 minutes long. It is very short, which is like horror films often benefit from being short and snappy. But this is a film where about 20 minutes of that is taken up by a flashback that is basically David Gordon Green doing his fan fiction that follows on immediately from the original Halloween, which I kind of got a kick out to a degree because I do like modern filmmakers replicating the styles of the late 1970s for this. And he does all of that great, like, no use of modern technology. It's all very much the filming techniques and the film grain and the lighting effects that you would have used in the 70s. So it looks like it could have literally been filmed by Carpenter. But that's 20 minutes of this film, which is just kind of like, essentially, you don't really need that. That's just him being like, I want to play around with my toys now. You then get the immediate aftermath of what happens after Halloween 2018, which brings Laurie into the picture, but she's very quickly pushed aside so they can focus on what is the main story of Halloween Kills, which is just the town deciding that they really don't like Michael Myers and now he's back.
They've had enough of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it goes to an interesting place eventually in that it wants to discuss the idea of like what mob mentality can do to a community. And they've become so obsessed with the idea of killing Michael Myers. It's obviously never going to go right. And it does eventually get there, but it's sort of, it feels like it takes so long to get to the point, and then it sort of almost like skips a beat that it should have investigated. That story never feels like it comes to terms. But what it ultimately does is it means that Laurie's barely in it, so it's not continuing her story, which is what 2018 was all about. And it ultimately feels like it did that so it could just have Michael Myers go around kill a bunch of people that don't really matter because they really wanted to do a kill montage. And
it's a
there
shame.
Are some entertaining kills
in
there.
I will still watch it just because I like Halloween a lot and I want to see the third one, so you know, even though you said it doesn't matter, I'll still watch it. Are you at least happy you've managed to get that off your chest?
Yeah.
I feel like this has been building up within you.
Yeah, it's gone now. It's gone.
Good. You've expelled pure evil for another year. yeah, there we go. What else? Oh, God, yeah. I forgot I had to talk about this. I don't have to. I've added it. So, if you may remember, was it a couple of years ago, both me and Joe, I think, talked about our real guilty pleasure of watching the Netflix series You. Were you on that as
well?
Yeah,
okay. It was
the Netflix series You, which season 3 came out on Friday. I may have already watched it all, despite still thinking it's a really bad television show.
I have to say, I'm very pleased to say that I've managed to resist the urge to watch You season 3. Like, something about it didn't pull me in like before.
You'll get there.
I probably will.
It's more of the same. It's nonsense. But that's the thing. So science does get, and it must get its hooks into people because everyone seems to watch it. It's one of the most watched things on Netflix. If you don't know the kind of concept of You, it's basically the TV show Dexter, but with the guy from Gossip Girl in it. so it's he's kind of a like you're supposed, and that's the weird thing of this show. You're supposed to, they position it from his point of view. You're supposed to sympathize it, although he is basically a very violent stalker. That is who he is, and it's an odd show. Season three is more of that oddness of just, like, I don't know, it makes no sense. But that is the thing I like about it, is it keeps you on your toes because it doesn't really work within the realms of human logic. So anything could happen at any point. Anyone could end up dead. Anyone can end up in a plastic cage in a basement. Like, anyone could end up there. And you're just like, oh, what's going to happen next? It ends, and, you know, it tees up what is going to be a full series. And you're like, oh, we're doing this again, are we?
I just opened the Wikipedia page because I wanted to remind myself if it was. It is a Greg Berlanti show, isn't it? Which is the guy that does Riverdale and all the CW kind of Arrowverse stuff.
Oh, it's absolute pap, but I do watch it. It is naff as all hell. There is some decent acting. So it's got Victoria Pedretti in, who I think is a very good actress. She's in Haunting of Hill House. She's very good in it. Like, I think she's a really good actress. And she's almost in bet. In some ways better than Penn Badgley, who is a real person.
I love
that
he's called Penn Badgley. I also love you sent around a little meme that showed that he looks exactly like a young Jose Mourinho, the football manager, which is very strange.
It's uncanny. And kind of like I could see Mourinho kind of speaking
keeping
to himself
in
like
a glass
the character
box.
Yeah, like I could see him looking at, I don't know, Michael Essien back in there going, you are the one I need.
He did. He did love Michael Essien.
I'm a Spurs fan. I love Michael Essien. That shows how good a player he was.
Damn.
It's just like, it's so, I just felt like I had to bring up, because I think a lot of people had joy in me and Joe moaning about it for, it felt like an hour a couple of years ago. We were like full on. But I've had no one to speak about it this year, so I just thought I'd get it out and say, God, it's nonsense. But part of me really loves it, because I'm like, this is mad. I just love how mad it is. They don't care. And it's in the, like, 90% of the characters you just absolutely hate. This third season is set in kind of a suburb, like, town outside of San Francisco, so it's got all that, like, sort of, like, valley people, like, really obsessed with all the health stuff, like, really just obnoxious individuals. And that's the kind of thing it does, is although the lead character is just a sociopathic stalker of people and a murderer, the people he kills are equally obnoxious. So you're like, do you know what, I don't care if they're gone. like it's really odd, and I don't think I could recommend it to anyone. I don't think I need to, because it's on the front page of Netflix whenever you turn it on. So,
and it's not like there's nothing else on Netflix to watch, is it?
I went through it all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 10 episodes, 40 minutes each or so. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've got it done.
Yeah. By the way, I watched Midnight Mass, Cardi. It was fucking incredible.
It's so good.
It is. I mean, and hot on the heels of having watched Squid Game, which I also thought was incredible, to then have something that I think I might have enjoyed more. I can't believe how good Midnight Mass was.
It's phenomenal, yeah.
Yeah, I think I find it very hard to believe I'll watch anything better than that this year. Like, it's truly, truly wonderful.
I think it's at number two for me. I think I have Squid Game 3, Midnight Mass 2. I think I still have Mayor of Easttown 1.
Right. Oh, I never got around to that. I should try that.
Yeah. But, yeah, some great television this year. You, not included. but you know what? I watched it all. And I would be lying if I say I didn't enjoy it to some extent. It is the perfect... I must have played, I don't know, a good 200 games of online solitaire while watching that. Mm-hmm. I had a great week off.
I have just realised that Succession just started and I haven't watched that yet. So
the first episode picks up right where you want it to. It's amazing.
I know this isn't necessarily everyone's bag, but this season of Bake Off is very fucking good. So
I've heard a lot about this Jürgen chap.
Oh, mate, Jürgen and Giuseppe are two of the shining lights of Bake Off this year. I absolutely love them both.
Fantastic.
Yeah, wonderful people.
We'll probably talk about Succession more once it's either finished or a few episodes in, because there's only one episode in. And surprise, surprise, it's still probably the best ongoing television program on at the moment.
Also, it's pastry week in Bake Off next week, so I'll probably be back to talk about that. The savoury showstopper, come on, that's a highlight every year.
From one savoury showstopper to another, I talked to Denis Villeneuve.
I don't know what it means, but it sounds good.
Yeah, neither do I. About Spice, which is a savoury showstopper to an extent. My little 15-minute chat with Denis Villeneuve, the director of Dune. We talk about a lot of things. Don't worry, we do talk about The Prestige, of course.
Yes.
Enjoy this little chat. Like I said at the start, completely spoiler-free, so yeah, watch it. Watch it, even. Listen to it before you watch it, or after. The film is actually out today, I think. It is out now. It is out on HBO Max. Just watch it. Like, I'm not one of these people who's like, oh, you have to watch it on the big screen possible. This is a film that you should watch at the cinema, I think, anyway. It's just incredible to see a cinema. Anyway, enjoy this chat with Denis Villeneuve, where I'm sure he'd agree. Hi, Denis.
Hello, Simon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. To begin with, we always ask the same couple of quick-fire questions to our guests, so I'm sorry if these are hard to answer, because a lot of people struggle to answer them. And one of them is a question I hate being asked myself, which is, do you have a favourite film? And, or is there one that you always like go back to? Not necessarily one that you call your favourite.
That one of my favourite film of all time, and it's a movie that I frankly saw at an early age that I didn't understand, but I was really impressed by, and that I revisited through years and after, and every time I watch it again, there's still something new that I see, and it's one of the most precise and most powerful movie ever made, cinematic movie, is 2001: A Space Odyssey. Still today, I would say, it's like, if I had to pick one, it would be definitely that one.
I watched that recently. It's unbelievable to think that film was made in 1968, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I had the great chance to watch it recently in 70mm in a theater, and the impact of 2001 on a big screen is incredible. It's really a total masterpiece. Yeah.
So I work for IGN, and we cover films, TV, but we also cover video games. Well, I'm not sure if you have any history of video games, or if you'd have a video game you'd call a favorite that you played.
I will say that when I was young, a game that I really loved was Lunar Lander, which was like, you were not born when we were playing that game. and it's a very basic one, but I still, every time I see it, I still have a vivid, cool memory of playing with that game, where you have to land a lunar lander on the moon using thruster. Mm-hmm. Very simple, very tricky, very simple, but very fun.
You're kind of doing that for real now. You've brought that to life. And are we going to have a Lunar Lander film from you? Is one thing.
I thought I'd be very surprised.
Just two more quickfire ones. Have you got a favorite TV show, or maybe one at the moment that you're watching?
I would say that a TV show that really impressed me in the past was In Treatment. That TV show where it's a while ago, where you follow the therapeutic process of several characters and their relationship with the therapist, psychotherapist. I thought that was like really brilliant TV. Yeah.
And a fourth one, this may seem just a bit out of nowhere. Have you seen, and what do you think of, Christopher Nolan's The Prestige?
I've seen this movie a while ago, and I remember enjoying it. I think another impressive movie from Christopher Nolan. It's not my favorite of Nolan's work, but again, mm-hmm. But I've seen this movie a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. The reason I ask is because it's kind of almost our podcast's mascot film. Like we all love that film, and okay. We love it so much that a couple of years ago we put our own cinema screening of it just so we could see it on the big screen.
Beautiful.
But thank you for answering those. Now I'll talk to you about Dune, which is why we're actually here. Could you maybe give a brief introduction to the world of Dune for anyone not familiar?
It's very simple. You know, when you watch Dune, you just need to know one thing, that there's a substance, very precious substance, that helps to travel in space, and you could see this substance is called spice, and you could see it as a metaphor for oil, what is oil to our world, spice is to Dune's world. And that's the most important. If you know that, you will understand the story.
Amazing. And what is it about the world of Dune that got its hooks into you at such a young age? Why do you love Dune, essentially?
I think that I was super impressed by that culture that was created by Frank Herbert, the Fremen. These people living in the deep desert of Arrakis that had adapted to those harsh conditions, the toughest conditions, developing technologies that, like those incredible suits that recycles their own water or the way they developed different techniques to survive. Like one of them is how to cross a desert without attracting a sandworm, because the sandworm being our predators living under the sand, and they are attracted by by rhythmic noises. So if you walk on the sand, you will be attacked and devoured by a sandworm. So how they develop a technique which is called a sand walk, where they dance without rhythm on the sand in order to emulate the sound of the desert. That, I think, is awesome ideas. I mean, it's like all the Fremen technique and their relationship with the environment, the way they are one with their ecosystem. I thought it was absolutely poetic and powerful and very impressive ideas when I read that at first as a teen.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the Fremen, and they obviously live in a planet just covered in sand. It's essentially a desert. How important was it for you to actually go and film out in the desert rather than on a green screen?
It was essential because you cannot recreate the epicness, the grandeur, the size of those sand dunes and on the back lot. I needed to be in the real environment, to embrace the landscape and to receive the impact of this landscape on our psyche as we were making it. And so we would be me and the cinematographer and the actors inspired by those landscape in order to bring the movie to life. And for the people who will watch the movie, they will understand that it would have not been possible to shoot that on a backlot or on green screen. It's too vast, too big. It's too powerful.
I recently rewatched Arrival, actually, and something that struck me with that, which is similar to Dune in a way, is just the sense of scale, especially when we first see the spaceships in Arrival, just how vast they are in the open landscape. It reminded me of some of the shots in Dune when we see some of the massive dropships coming down. I think you're one of the best filmmakers I can remember of just bringing across that sense of scale. How do you achieve that in your films?
I think the it's not about how I achieve, it's more the spirit, the idea behind is that the humanity, in order to survive in the environment, has to create those massive machines in order to survive space. And it just brings back humanity into a certain humility regarding to their relationship with nature.
And similar with Arrival, Blade Runner, Dune, these are all kind of massive scale projects on planets and worlds we don't know. Is it a tough balancing act? Because they're also, at their core, very personal, emotionally driven films about people. Is that a tough balancing act to do, to bring these most very small-scale personal stories but balance them with whole world issues?
Yeah, the thing is that you will believe in the world if you believe into the emotion, the interaction and the emotion and the relationships of this character. So yes, you're right. It's like it's a tough equilibrium that is necessary in order for the movie to work. It's one of the main focus. It's my job to make sure that the complexity, the beauty, the of these interaction, of these emotional, of these personal journeys are at the forefront of the story. So the rest will follow. You will believe, for instance, you will believe that they are extraterrestrial if you believe in Amy Adams' character in Arrival. So it's like that's essential to find that equilibrium. Yeah,
I think I saw this in the cinema, which I think you'd probably agree to me is the only way to see this film. I was just kind of blown away, basically. I think it's the loudest screening I've maybe ever been to. It's just like a wall of noise, which I enjoyed it. And one thing that stood out to me was Hans Zimmer's score, which kind of doesn't really, to me, sound like any of his other scores. It's kind of, there's no real rhythm to it. It's kind of, there's like a cacophony of chanting, like bagpipes, a lot of noise. Like, what was it like hearing that for the first time? Are you like, that is what Dune sounds like in my head?
It was a long process. It's not something that came out spontaneously. Ants was obsessed with the idea of designing new sounds, sounds that will come out from another world. He was obsessed with the idea of to approach rhythm in a different way. He wanted to get out of his comfort zone. He wanted, in a way, Hans is a master. He had composed many scores, but I think that for him, he wanted the Dune score to be unique. And it was like very important for him that this score will have a strong identity and will be very different than what he had done before. And it was very moving for me to see this master trying to reinvent himself. And it was so inspiring to watch him putting himself in out of his comfort zone, I think one of the strength of the movie is definitely Hans' score that brings a beautiful spirituality, a feeling of an alien world, and also give hints about the characters' motivations. I think it's really deeply in love with the score.
Me too. At times, it's not a relaxing score. I've tried writing to it, and it's just too much noise for me to concentrate.
It's intense. It's a score that, you're absolutely right. The score is pretty intense, and it's a score that it's deeply embedded in the DNA of the movie. And I'm wondering how the score can be absorbed outside of the movie, but it's like it's a really powerful score. Yeah.
Maybe a sports stadium, a team comes out to the bagpipes or something. I don't know. If I own a sports team, I'd play part of this score, just so you know. Another thing that struck me was just, especially with the Harkonnen, like how frightening some of that imagery was. And especially early on, not necessarily with the Harkonnen, but the hand in the box scene, which is obviously an iconic scene from Dune, just how scary some of that imagery was. I wasn't expecting it to be that dark. I enjoyed it, and I was just wondering, what were the inspirations like? Some of that seems quite gothic, some of that imagery and some of the costume design especially.
All these ideas came from the book. I mean, from that, in the book there's like you feel when you read the book that it's like a strange there's a period quality to the way the culture are described. It's almost like a historical book. It feels like you're not sure Herbert was talking about the past or our future. You know, that there are so many roots in Earth culture so I tried to be faithful to that. Jacqueline West designed costume that were, she, Jacqueline really went at the roots of Frank Herbert's writing again. All this imagery was directly linked with the book.
I feel like it's obviously been a long wait for this, as it has been for a lot of films over the past year and a half. And we've waited so people can watch it in the cinema. What do you want people to get from Dune? When they finish watching Dune, what sort of feeling do you want to get across, do you think?
But the thing is, when I do movies, I love the audience to be totally free. You know, it's a bit like, for me, movies are like poems. When you write a poem, you don't want to tell the people what to think after. They have to have their own interpretation, their own... and I love the people to go back home I hope people will be haunted by the film. They will be... they will feel... inspired by the images, and I hope that they will bring that back home, and that they will have maybe the curiosity to open the book, because it's really a beautiful book. But what they will take out from the message of the book, that belongs to them.
Is that something you'd, because I was wondering, that is that something you'd encourage people to do before seeing the film? Do you think
read the book, then see the film? Or at this point, if you haven't read the book, just go in without knowing?
People don't need to read the book to watch the film. That was the challenge that we had as we were writing the screenplay. We wanted everybody to feel welcome and to understand this movie, even without having to read the book. So it's not there's no homework to be done. When you watch Dune, you can just enter the movie theater and hopefully have fun watching it.
I mean, I certainly did. And I can't wait personally for part two, whenever that gets around to happening, presumably. I mean, is that what you plan to do next? Or have you got other projects you'd like to get to maybe before that take a break? I'm not sure.
To answer to your question is that it will be a bit awkward for me to leave something unfinished. Before doing anything else, I will definitely need to finish Dune. My priority, and I pray the gods of cinema that it will happen, my priority will be definitely Dune 2.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, I can't wait for that. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your great questions. And by the way, there was something very fresh about your question, which I really appreciate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that a lot. I appreciate your films a lot. So thank you very much.
Take care.
And there we have it. Denis Villeneuve, a lovely and very interesting man with a very, very bassy voice and very French-Canadian voice as well.
Well, and also the incorrect opinion about The Prestige. He's really let me down. First,
he said he liked it.
Yeah, but not his favourite Nolan film. Bugger off.
Yeah, but it's not my favourite Nolan either.
Yeah, but we've already established that you're a Philistine and a rube. a goon, even. I'm pretty upset about that, to be honest. First, I didn't think Dune was all that, and now he's saying this shit about The Prestige. Come on. What's the fucking point?
Well, he's not coming. I'm not going to be able to chat to him again now after he listens to that, am I?
I thought he's a great chat. I've chatted him too. He's a lovely boy. I think he's very nice. I think he thinks very and deeply about his sci-fi worlds in a way that I love.
And he makes incredible films. Should we do an endless search?
Yeah. Inside. It's a UK IGN crew. Yeah. Yeah, and the ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside. I got a question for you. Hold tight the DJ, we coming through. Yeah, and the ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside. I got a question for you. Is it in the search?
Matt, what are we playing, baby?
We are playing the game of which the official title I cannot remember because I'm sure we've used like three by now, but it's the Metacritic higher or lower game.
Oh, yes, I love this one.
I like it, and rarely do I get to actually play this one.
So
and I'm looking forward to this.
Historically, we've always done this with games, I think. So we're going to do it with films.
We might have done it once with films. Let's do it with films, though, yeah.
And also, I didn't want to stick it like normally. It's always like it's always the highest one or it's always the lowest one. We're mixing it up. Alternating.
Okay.
Oh, wow. This is a real grab bag of joy.
There we go.
I'll never feel settled.
Our first category. I want you to give me the highest ranked Marvel movie on Metacritic. What has the highest rating? When I say Marvel movie, it can literally be any film that's based on a Marvel property. You don't have to stay within the MCU.
Okay.
Cool. Who's going first? Okay.
I'm going to do it in the order of which you are on my screen, so Cardi gets to go first.
Bollocks!
Well, I didn't want to go first necessarily, so I was trying
to think
through.
Well, you're going first. Give me a Marvel
film. Is there a very obvious one here that has a high Metacritic, is what I'm thinking. So I don't know, like, although I think, like, Infinity War is an incredible film and Endgame, like, were they largely reviewed well by media as a whole, or do I go slightly off base, which is what I might do because I feel like this was on a Metacritic more liked by film critics than a lot of films. I'm gonna go with Logan.
Shit, you bastard.
Logan. Excellent choice,
because I'm almost positive that is the highest one. I will go for Infinity War.
You're gonna go for Infinity War as well?
On
I'm just not sure.
PlayStation 5, please.
Here we go then. Right. Of course, the thing is with film is there's a bigger pool, isn't there? There's all these newspapers that review them.
I mean, and back in the day, like when the first, like Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, I was like, this is great. And maybe it reviewed really well because comparatively, you know, it was fresh.
Right. Cardi goes in with Logan. The meta score, 77.
Whoa, that is seriously a lot lower than I thought. I thought that was an 80s guaranteed.
In my head, I genuinely thought that was like 93.
Nope. That's 77.
Who didn't like Logan?
I think you may have this.
Do you want to know who didn't like Logan? I'm going to out them.
I haven't seen it.
Rex Reed at The Observer didn't like Logan.
At least he's watched it, which I still haven't done. I looked at it several times.
You've not seen Logan?
That is absurd, man. It's really good.
It's just one of those. It's one of those. I watched so many. I watched like 10 films last week, and one of them was not Logan.
I went with my housemate to the midnight screening of Logan on the first night. It was epic. Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah.
Metascore, 68.
Oh my good lord.
That is.
How is that? I bet that was fucking Rex Reed and all.
Who didn't like. There is only one negative review of Infinity War. From the Globe and Mail, John Semley. Even by Marvel's own standards of serviceable mediocrity, Infinity War fails.
Grow up, fails. John. Or grow down, whichever you prefer.
68. That's surprising.
Yeah, but
me.
How has it only got one negative review and it's ended up on 68?
A lot of middlings.
Did he give it minus 30?
There's a lot. So there's 14 mixed reviews and 39 positives. But obviously positive can go down to 60, seven. Right? Like 61, I think, is
boo.
The...
Boo! Boo!
There you go.
Boo.
I did not expect to win that with a 77.
It was exciting.
Here we are.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's flip it round. I want the lowest ranked on Metacritic of a film based on a DC comic.
Oh, that's a Again, large selection of those, isn't there?
Not just the DCEU. You can go beyond the DCEU.
Okay.
Joe.
Yeah. Oh, which one was first and which one was second? Shit.
I don't know what you're...
Can I ask which way round two films came? Just because I can't remember which one it is. Batman and Robin or Batman Forever? Which was the second one?
Batman Forever is the... I don't know which one. Batman Forever is the...
Is the Val Kilmer.
Jim Carrey one.
Right.
Batman and Robin's the Arnold Schwarzenegger one.
Yeah. I think I mean Batman and Robin. I'm going to go Batman and Robin.
So I'm not going for either of those. I'm going to go for Catwoman.
Oh, that's a great shout.
Very good shout.
Well done, mate. Well done.
I don't know. They're both notoriously two of the worst films ever made.
I've got to find the movie, because Catwoman has a video game.
I've just remembered Batman and Robin's the one where fucking Jonathan Ross, as a bet, gave it 5 stars.
Are you going to blame Jonathan Ross?
It might be TV, so it might be okay.
You might want to like not worry too much there, Joe, because Batman and Robin does only have one positive review. But that came from Elvis Mitchell at the New York Times, and it's not a 5-star. So Jonathan Ross's is not included.
I think he might have been on film thing.
What would that have been? Film 1997.
That's the one.
This is a close one, boys. There's a point in it. A single point.
Battle of the Stinkers. That's not me,
Joe. Batman and Robin has a meta score of 28.
Okay.
Oh, that is poor.
Cardi.
Yeah.
Catwoman has a meta score of 27.
No! Make sure everyone doesn't tweet me. Jonathan Ross, in fact, gave the very positive review to Batman Forever, where he called it one of the greatest movies ever made.
What was Batman Forever out of interest, Matt? Would that
Let's have a look at Batman Forever.
I feel like that would be more like a 34. I feel like that's a little bit better.
51.
Wow.
51, okay. That's not by any means a good film. No. It's not a stinker.
But that was Jim Carrey's big period where I think people were willing to say...
Yeah.
If Jim Carrey's in something, it's probably
Tommy Lee Jones is two-facing a bizarre performance.
Is that the one? No, it was Batman and Robin that had Irma Thurman, right? Yeah,
Poison Ivy. Yeah, God. And those bizarre Bane costume.
Those are basically one film to me. Just one big mulch of shit.
Right. Okay. A very wide topic here that you can choose from. I want the highest ranked Netflix original television series.
Ooh.
Cardi, your pick first.
Just trying to wrap my brains of which... Sorry, does that have to be a drama? Could be a documentary series.
Anything that is considered...
Anything.
When it that flashes up at the start, a Netflix original series.
Well, then I can choose Star Trek Discovery, which is the lie they tell at the start of the UK version.
Okay. What's... There's a few things to pick from here, isn't there?
Mm.
Are we doing this by season or by show in general? Sorry,
ooh,
I'm sorry to be...
That's a good point, because I might not be able to... I'm just going to use something that we've...
Look up Jessica Jones, because neither of us is going to say Jessica Jones.
You didn't know that.
I did.
They just have it as a single thing, which I'm guessing they pull from season one.
Okay.
There's a few things. I'd hate that I have to go first here. Right. Joe, I'm going to go for the original. I'm going to go with House of Cards. Because I think it reviewed very well.
House of Cards.
I would have gone for season one if I had tried, because it did trail off a little bit.
Okay, yeah, so. I'm hoping for a similar season one vibe. Oh, actually, I'm going to go Wild Wild Country.
Oh, hello.
Which strikes me as the kind of thing that wouldn't get reviewed everywhere and would get reviewed by people who liked it. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'm wrong.
Right. Cardi, House of Cards, has a Metascore of 73.
Mm.
Joe, Wild Wild Country has a Metascore of... 79.
Yes!
He's gone full bag one.
I've gone full bag one.
They said it couldn't be done again, and he's done it.
Right.
I forgot about full bag one.
I'd forgotten about that show. I don't know if we ever mentioned full bag one on this podcast before, but I know we said it to each other.
It's just a gif of a load of people from Wild Wild Country going mad that we sent around every now and then. It was good.
Going full bag one.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Another lowest one.
About bag one.
I want the lowest ranked Mike Flanagan project.
Lowest.
So that can be a TV or a film.
God, I literally just rewatched the video we made about all his movies.
say The Haunting of Hill House. Yeah.
Okay.
Say that one.
Joe, you're up first.
Oh, piss off, would you? I don't think his first movie will be on there. They've all had quite good reactions. Is his fairy tale-y one called Before I Sleep? Is that what it was called? No, that's not it, is it? I should be able to remember the fucking movie title, shouldn't I?
That's key to the game.
Oh, because he made Doctor... Yeah. No, I'm not... I'll switch, because I'll get one where I actually know the title. Oculus. Yeah. I'll just go for Oculus.
You're going to go for Oculus.
It'll be mine.
Joe is Oculus.
You remind me, do I go Doctor Sleep? Because it was mixed. Reviews. Or do I go Gerald's Game, which I liked, but I don't know if it was very well reviewed. I was going to go Oculus.
Oh, it's Before I Wake.
I'm not going to go
in case you want it.
Nah. I'm torn between... Do you know what? I'm going to... I'm going to go with Doctor Sleep.
I think that's quite a good shout.
Let's have a look. Joe chose Oculus. 61 on Metacritic. Doctor Sleep, 59.
Oh,
nice.
It looks
like... Apparently the director's cut of Doctor Sleep is rather good. So maybe I'll watch that.
Right. I'm afraid Cardi has technically won.
That's fine.
We do have one round left if you'd like to partake.
I like this game a lot. Let's do it.
The highest ranked TV show adapted from a movie.
Ooh.
It's a very common thing these days. People adapting movies into long form TV.
And yeah, I can't think of any of them.
There is literally one. This is inspired by what I won't say what it is, but there is a horror one on at the moment based on a 1980s horror film, I think.
Can they be spin-offs?
Yeah, I think as long as it is like based from, like, so there was a movie back then, and now its characters have become new television show.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm asking, because the thing I've got in mind definitely didn't get that well reviewed.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, I've won. I can think of a lot, though, the other way around. I've got a couple that are...
I mean, if you can only think of bad ones, you're just trying to bid against which one has the least bad.
I can think of one that's okay, and I think probably reviewed okay, and I'm going to go with Bates Motel.
That was the one I thought didn't get reviewed well, so maybe Alan was wrong.
I thought it was okay. I watched the first season or two of that, but it was all right. But
Vera Farmiga.
I was about to say I'm not a critic. I am, but I'm not. I didn't review that.
I don't even remember whether people liked it or not, but I'm going to go with the Scream TV show.
Scream TV show. Okay. I am very surprised that neither of you bid in with Hannibal.
Oh, fuck.
Hannibal. I was going to say that's from a book.
I think about it. It's very much a book adaptation, actually, with just sort of visual references.
But could have gone for any of the stuff. Could have gone for Mandalorian, or could have gone for...
You could have gone for...
Anyway.
Well, I don't know. Could you have gone for Mandalorian? That's just based in the universe, isn't it, more so than a... Bates Motel is very clearly...
I mean, it had Luke Skywalker in it.
I would have lost it if you said that.
Right. Scream. 2015 TV show adaptation on MTV, apparently. What a place to release it.
Wow.
57. Yeah. Bates Motel, 69.
Yeah, fair enough.
Garden takes it.
What a winner. A lovely game. I do enjoy that game.
That's a
very
good
much.
Game.
Thank you, Matt, for the game.
Just yes.
The game. I was going to say something else, but that would have been... Again, lewd. Well, we're trying not to be lewd around here. Let's do some feedback, shall we?
Yeah.
I've got the first one from Lewis Glover, who says, "Hi, Gen UK crew. Last week on the podcast, Rory sent in a question about struggling to afford new games and their expensive prices. I thought I'd write in to tell you how I afford to get the new games I like to play. I use a website called The Game Collection to buy my new games, as they offer to spread the cost over 4 payments that is charged every 2 weeks. All this with no interest charges. I know Littlewoods and Very offer a similar service, but you do pay a bit more on their stores. Would love to hear your thoughts on whether this is a good way to afford the latest and greatest games being released. Best regards, and have a great weekend." That does sound like a good way of doing it. As long as you're not the founder of the game collection, are you, Lewis? This isn't just a big advert we've done here. But I never did that. I remember when I was younger, I used to either do the thing of buy the game, play it as quick as I can, trade it in to get maximum value back, which is not the most relaxed way to do it. Or like there's still websites where you can, like Love Film used to do games, or like when Netflix was originally a mailing service, like. I don't know. I used to... Even my local library did games. Like, you paid £2 for a week, and you could take a game. They never really had the latest ones. They were always, like, older games. But, yeah, I don't know. Is there any way you can rent games these days?
I must say, I don't know. But I guess you know, your streaming services are increasingly the thing that people would kind of compare. But, yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. But, rented all sorts of shit.
Mm-hmm. I bet you did. I don't want to know.
Earthworm Jim, Ren and Stimpy, Boogerman. Just all the ones about people throwing snot at each other. They were great. Good.
I distinctly remember.
Games.
Maybe the best £2 I ever spent at my local library renting 24 the game for PS2 and playing through that in a week. What a lovely time. Innocent times. And an enjoyable game. Yeah, seems like a good way of doing it, though. So that'd be, what, like £15 every 2 weeks? I mean, it's not terrible, is it, if you're getting through those games as well? Especially if it's a big game that's like 100 hours long, then, you know, probably over the course of 2 months playing that anyway.
Straight up.
There we go. Exactly. Matt.
Right, got one in from Andrew Boke, who says, "Hi all, apologies for the long email, but I have three things for the attention of all you guys, gals, and non-binary pals. Number one, I have no idea what the fuck Sainsbury's know that we lowly non-Sainsbury's people don't, but I attach a screenshot of the first two hits you get, skipping the sponsored stuff, on the Sainsbury's website when you search for kid shampoo. Gonna assume, Andrew, that you are a dad. Not one, but two Müller Corner yogurts, the top two hits, skipping the sponsored stuff. There are two alternatives here. One is that, other than being delicious, the humble Müller Corner also has a strong yet sensitive cleaning properties. But if that's the case, why, by Guy's green tits, wouldn't Johnny Müller be screaming this from the rooftops?
Johnny Müller!
The other alternative is much more sinister, that all this time the alluring sheen of Britain's favourite off-milk with a corner reservoir product is the result of it being derived from soap, coating your guts with an indulgent but no tears lava. This conspiracy clearly goes right to the top of the bloody corner, that is. Well, I guess there is a third alternative, and it's just a weird glitch that is coincidentally extremely relevant to the IGN UK podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, do we have anything to say about the fact that Müller Corner might be shampoo?
I'm not going to try it. Have you ever accidentally used something that's not shampoo to wash your hair?
Well, not accidentally, because I don't have a fridge in my shower.
Yeah, only ever,
no,
like...
It has to be...
Have you put toothpaste in your hair, is that what you're going to say?
No, I've definitely accidentally sprayed deodorant instead of hairspray in my hair.
Are you using a lot of hairspray?
When I was like 18 to 20, like university years, when I had longer hair like I do now, just to stop it, you know, flying around all the place.
Get back in your hairspray game.
I've got some now. It's just no. I have no cause to use it.
Is it Ultra Freeze? Is it the superpowered stuff?
I think it was. It might have been Stronghold.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember, but yeah, I definitely put deodorant in my hair, which didn't really do anything. But you know, it's just like just my hair spelled with deodorant.
Yeah, it's pretty fun anecdote.
Bit wet. I could use hairspray on my armpits, and yeah. Oh, what a fun time I had,
Matt. Are you glad you asked us to stop halfway through the email to talk a bit about this?
Absolutely. Yeah, right. Back to Andrew then, eh?
But yeah, don't put yogurts in your hair.
Yeah. Number 2 point. A couple of episodes back, you talked about the condition aphantasia, and I wanted to bring you and the listeners attention to Laura Kate Dale's fantastic YouTube series called Accessibility. It actually has an episode all about this condition. There is a link. We obviously cannot send you a link because this is audio, so I guess search for accessibility on YouTube and how it relates to video games. Her stuff is well worth a look if you're interested in the unique challenges certain disabled, neurodivergent and marginalised people face when playing video games.
I knew about that series. I didn't know about the episode on aphantasia, so I'm very excited to go and have a look.
Really,
that sounds really interesting.
Thought about how that might affect you, because it's such a visual medium that you don't think about the idea that you might need imagination to use it, but there must be some very interesting elements there. Number 3, related to the previous point, the disability charity Scope is running the Power Up and Play charity event from the 1st to the 10th of November. There's going to be lots of charity gaming live streams, and the website gives you quite a bit of guidance if you want to get involved yourself in raising some money through playing video games. I will probably be fundraising in some capacity. I am currently being assessed for ADHD and autism, and my wife is Scope's head of finance, so I probably should.
Yeah.
And it would be great to
this
see
one
other
is
duck
an
hunters.
Ad.
Yeah, there we go. It would be great to see other duck hunters donating or fundraising too. My love to you all and respect to the sea from Andrew.
I'm okay if the ad is for the charity Scope.
It's probably quite good.
Andrew,
when you do start fundraising, send us the link for that and we will popularize it by the medium of Twitter. That's very good. I'm up for that.
Maybe we could have a. Do you think there's like a professional eating for yogurts? Like they have the hot dogs. Do you think they're Müller Corners?
Can you imagine overeating yogurt?
How much yogurt can you eat in 10 minutes?
Imagine the curdled, cornflake-filled sick you'd have after a bunch of corners. No, thank you.
I think you have to do one of every flavour. What did we have? Was there like 18 to 20 or something currently in circulation? Yeah. How quickly can you get through all of them? Would you just bung them all in a bucket, or would you have them one by one?
Like when you're a kid and you put all the paints in one thing and it comes out brown. Yeah.
did you ever have like a do cereal mixes, like put three different cereals in a bowl?
Yeah, and it was always shit.
Yeah, I remember, you'd have like golden nuggets with cocoa pops. You're like, this will be amazing. It's like, golden nuggets in like a chocolate milk. It's just never right.
What do you reckon the hack is for getting down corners? Because like, you know, when they do hot dog eating challenges, they like dunk the things in water and just slide them down their gullet like fucking snakes. you really enjoying the medium.
You want to empty them all into like a flask, right? So you can drink it.
You want to drink the others.
I was thinking for high speed, you'd go snap, put the topping in, snap back, and then get your hand, like your fist underneath, put it over your face and just punch, like invert the yogurt container directly into your face.
Do you think that's what was on, like, they check every Müller corner, like if you've left any, like if you've even left one vanilla choc ball left in the thing, like disqualified?
That would be dirty if they did that, surely not. Toppings, I think, I yogurt, you can't have more than 5 milliliters left. You have to be licking the tub.
There's a tense bit right at the end where they're pouring it into a jug and it's like, it's 4.2 milliliters.
Dude's throwing chocolate cornflakes up in the air over his head like confetti. I'd watch it.
Amazing. I'd definitely watch it. And do you know what? I'd watch it even more if it was hosted by The Rock playing Blackadder. Hosting.
Yes.
The Muller eating contest. What are we on about? One more email.
This is from David Swanborough, which I like as a name. Been listening since episode 99. Too long. I think this is the first time I've written in. Again, too long. Although my email account remembers the address, so I doubt it. Okay. What a roller coaster. I was recently catching up on some podcasts I've missed, due to podcasts being a way to ignore annoying people who dare get the same trains as I do, and lockdown meaning no train journeys to work for a while. I get that. I was listening to podcast 599 just before the Green Street one. I hope you listened to the entire Green Street episode. I was listening to podcast 599, Loki spoilers and brilliant RPGs you haven't played, and was blown away by the description of Wildermyth and had to download it. I also immediately tweeted the devs, who confirmed a console release is in the works, which will be about a year. The tweet was liked by yourselves, which was a highlight on my Twitter. I did that like because I liked that you were talking about us. This led me to a question. Have you ever had a game described to you that has led to you immediately downloading / buying the game? I played a couple of hours of Wildermyth, and it's brilliant. Yes, Wildermyth. When Matt said it on that podcast, I bought it while we were on there.
Inscriptionist one. Not that Joe explained to me. I saw him tweet about it once. I was like, yeah, I'm into this. Also, I mean, Disco Elysium is one. Like, when Matt just said, here's this. And then, ended up giving it a 10 for IGN. So, thought it was good in the end.
There must have been loads of these.
Those are some ones that stick out in my...
It's not so much buying it immediately, but the first time I had Shadow of Mordor described to me, I remember, because I don't like Lord of the Rings, so I just didn't care about it at all. And then someone described the Nemesis system, and I went, oh my good lord, I want to play this game immediately.
I remember reading, it was when I worked in retail, and I was reading on a break, Eurogamer's like very first preview of Divinity Original Sin, and... I can't remember the writer on it, but the way that they described kind of like the element system about how you can kind of like stab people, make them bleed, then freeze their blood and get them to slip up on their own blood puddles. Like, that was something that I immediately went home and then bought that
You've
game.
Always wanted to do that. You've always wanted to freeze the blood of the innocents and slip on it.
What was the... I just had a thought about one. The first time I was... This is way back in the day. I was reading some unofficial PlayStation magazine in Sainsbury's while I waited for my mum. And someone described the taser in Siphon Filter as being able to turn goons' guts into soup. And I immediately wanted to play that game. So there you go. That's mine.
Beautiful. For example, maybe you can write into IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com if you've ever had that of... someone just like one line about a game and you were sold potentially. Maybe we've done that today with Inscription. Maybe people have gone, I need to play that. I hope so, because you should.
I agree. Can I just add, David finishes by doing a thing I quite like for a first-time writer in a, if indeed he is one. Just giving us a roundup of all the important details as regards the podcast. So,
good.
Fave Crisps, Walker's Max Paprika. I love those. They're really good. Fave Yogurt, Asda's Extra Special Lemon Curd, which I've never had before. He has not been possessed or nearly drowned. That's sad.
Good.
For us, not for you. And I didn't know what an onsen was until this podcast, and I'm still unsure why people go, as they just see places for horror stories. if you read this out, thank you. Regardless, thank you for the hours of not hearing strangers and confusing them as I laugh randomly for what seems to be no reason. Respect the sea and protect the whales.
Yes.
David Swanborough, although he usually goes by Munchie.
I like that a lot, Munchie.
Cheers, Munchie. I wish I'd read that right at the start. Sorry.
I feel like the onsen is maybe where we need to have our next live podcast. We need to find an onsen and have it there, because
all of us have to get in the electric one.
It feels like a place you could both get possessed and nearly drown. It kind of really does bring everything together. Just sit in an onsen, have a muller corner.
That'd be all right, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Oh, we did say this would be a long one. And I'm going to break it to you. It's going to be another 100 minutes. Almost bang on. What music do we have at the end? We've got...
Blackadder. The Blackadder theme tune.
it's got to be the Blackadder theme tune.
But from which season? Which series Blackadder?
Two, I think.
Big lyrics in the second one.
Yeah. Big lyrics, huge stuff. I'd love to see the Rock's rendition of
it. It's those Blackadder BLs coming at you on the IGN UK podcast. Big lyrics, big laughs. See you
later.
There
we go. Did we have Blackadder in there? You just on a sign off. I was going to carry on. Did we actually have him in the sitcom Smash? I don't know. Did we have Blackadder at any point?
I don't think Blackadder came up, no.
Well, when The Rock plays him, perfect.
Yeah, I mean, roster. He goes from like a little shit boy character to an absolute tank, so that's good.
Exactly. Maybe he morphs between the two.
Could do. And he throws Baldrick at people.
Exactly. Oh god, what a game this is never gonna be. Okay, let's go, because it's been a long one.
Okay,
goodbye everybody,
see ya, bye.
Some clash or twitch the hatter's beard, from now he always shall be single. To fall in love with boys is weird, especially boys without a tingle. Blackadder, Blackadder, his taste is rather odd. Blackadder, Blackadder, a randy little sod. Lord Flashcott, I wish you were the star. Lord Flashcott, you're sexy.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.